This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 2nd of November, 1955. The title of this lecture is Randomity and Automaticity. This lecture is 60 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
All right, this second morning lecture, 4th London ACC. November the 2nd, 1955. Just a minute while I mock up a time track. Oh, I mock up a time track, but it goes into havingness in the audience. Yeah. Yeah, so that's what you're doing. All right. We have some material to cover, which is very, very old material, and you can go to sleep if you want to, because I'm sure you know all this material very easily and very well. And the material is automaticity and randomity. If I had a textbook, I'd read you a couple of the axioms about it, but doesn't matter. Automaticity and randomity. Well, we look over this subject of automaticity and randomity, and we find out that the earliest introduction of automaticity and randomity found randomity being called rondamity. This technical term, invented more or less out of whole cloth, nevertheless was needful to express a condition which we had spotted in the science of life. And as we'd spotted this condition, why, we had to call it something, so we call it that. This is not very new, by the way. This is quite old. We find the earliest mention of that in the Dianetic Axioms, clear back in 1951 fall is when these Dianetic Axioms were written. And we look these over, and we come down the line here just to make sure I get the first axiom. I've never memorized these things. Did them and not know them, you know. We find that this word, randomity, was needed as a further expression of motion. And I've been talking to you recently about things which were too motionless, you know, tolerance of things which were motionless, and tolerance of things which had too much motion. And if you had to increase your tolerance of this, well, to show that people have difficulties with these tolerances of things that are too motionless and too motionful, we had, with this word, randomity, a rather upset circumstance. People didn't like to grasp this word. But we have a further explanation of it today, and as a result of that further explanation, we have a better chance of gripping this and using it. Now, in all scientific systems, you have a number of code words which operate as communication carriers. And when a person does not know these words well, he's having difficulty with the science itself. I've seen a senior in science falling down in his comprehension of a later part of the science because he had never gotten the nomenclature of the science straight to begin with. He did not know exactly what a British thermal unit was or something like this. He didn't have an idea of it, and therefore later on he's solving some vast and involved problem, and there's a datum rambling around in his head, and it's not stable at all. It's getting confused. It's mixed up with all other data, and that's just because he didn't understand what the term was in the first place. So just as you learn semaphore signals, just as you learn Morse code, just as you learn baby talk, so when you become conversant with any particular specialized subject, you must become conversant first and foremost with its terminology. And having become conversant with its terminology, your understanding of it then increases. Otherwise, your understanding is impeded by these words rattling around and not joining themselves to anything. You know vaguely that such a thing existed, and you have no real understanding of what it means, and therefore it does not align. So misunderstanding of a word can cause a misalignment of a subject, and this really is the basis of the primary confusion in understanding the mind. There have been so many words assigned to various parts of the mind that one would be staggered if he cataloged all these things. For instance, the tremendous technology and background of psychoanalysis, overpoweringly complicated material. Most of it merely descriptive, some of it action terminology, such as the censor, the id, the ego, the alter ego, Oedipus, etc. complexes, and also whatnots, you know. And all of these things all lined up, each one of them in a specific thing. But the practitioners who began to study this science did not have a good founding in the exact sciences. In other words, they didn't have a model of the exact sciences. Usually they did not have a thoroughgoing exact science background, you know. They had a humanity background. And in the humanities, they could be as careless as they liked with their words, because the sciences themselves were not themselves precisely exact. So you could get away with a great many things. Not criticism of them, it just means that you could have a looser command of the language. When people started then to study Freud, they got into this interesting thing. To one person, an id was one thing, and to another person, it was something else. An alter ego was this, and it was that. Confusion of terms there, practically all by itself, became the totality of confusion of psychoanalysis. Actually, psychoanalysis is as easy to understand, certainly, as Japanese. Japanese is a baby talk. Japanese, hard to read, very, very hard to read, very, very easy to talk. If you can imagine a language which tells you which is the subject, which is the verb, and which is the object, every time it speaks, you can imagine it's kind of an idiotic language. One that doesn't have various classes or conjugations of verbs. You know, just a very, very faint thing. But nevertheless, it merely consists, in order to communicate with the Japanese and to communicate in Japanese, of knowing the meanings of certain words. And if you know those meanings precisely, then when some Japanese comes up to you and says, "Do you want a cup of tea?" you don't immediately get up because you thought he said wet paint. You see, you have a communication possibility. Well, similarly in a language, the great difficulties inherent in understanding such a thing as psychoanalysis became much less difficult when one viewed psychoanalysis as a code system to relay certain meanings. Now, it did not then become a problem of whether or not these phenomena existed or didn't exist. It simply became a problem of words meaning a certain precise thing. And if they meant that thing to everybody, then everybody was talking psychoanalysis. And if it did not mean this thing to everybody, then people weren't talking psychoanalysis. God knows what they were talking. And the next thing you know, they were talking Jungianism. The next thing you're talking Adlerianism. And the amount of difference between these various items is minute, to say the least. But the language difficulties then made many practitioners in this field at odds with theories and so forth they did not understand. You'll find out in Scientology that a rather arduous background in mathematics and the what's laughingly called the exact sciences, nevertheless, made for a very arduously firm choice of word and definition. There are certain phenomena, and these phenomena are very specific. They are not random. They are very, very precise. For instance, an engram is an engram. It is a mental image picture of a moment of pain and unconsciousness. That is an engram. And you know that, well, you can find an engram. And if you think an engram is an energy trace on a cell or something, you won't find an engram. You get the idea? I've had this trouble already. The word engram early meant an energy trace on a cell. And this is not discoverable with microscopes or anything of the sort, so I considered it a lost word and quite accidentally crossed up this word with an earlier biological use. Therefore, biologists coming along looking at the word engram say, "Yes, I know what an engram is." Well, they know what they mean by engram, but they have never seen one. The engrams that we have, we can see, you see. But there was a confusion already. So they wouldn't quite know what you were talking about if they thought it was an energy trace on a cell. And you said, well, this fellow has engrams. And then naturally this fellow has engrams, but this fellow's not a cell. What you really meant was that this fellow has a number of cells on which there are energy traces. See how wild this could get just on this word engram. It's one of the few boo-boos in the subject itself as far as its nomenclature is concerned. What we did was take a verb, make a noun out of it most of the time, so that there wouldn't be any cross-up of definition. It's an interesting system, the system that's employed. We've tried to minimize the number of words introduced. That sounds strange, but we have tried to minimize it. We have only named those things which were really important to the auditor and given them special terminology. The only those things which were really important, phenomena which one really had to understand. Therefore, a knowledge of the exact definition of the word brought about an exact understanding of the phenomenon. It's as simple as this. Now, a knowledge of Scientology is first and foremost, then, a vocabulary knowledge. I don't know how many words there are of special meaning in Scientology, but there are probably not more than 60. I remember one time learning Igorote in a single night. I sat up by a kerosene lantern and took a list of words that had been made by an old missionary. Igorote, these are a people up in Luzon, in the Philippines. They have a very, very simple sort of baby talk language. And this missionary had phoneticized their language, and he had made a list of the main words and their uses and their grammar and so on. And I remember sitting up under a mosquito net with the mosquitoes very, very hungrily chomping their beaks just outside the net and learning this language, 300 words. Just simply sat down and memorized these 300 words and knew what they meant. And the next day, started to get them in line and align them with people, you see, and was speaking Igorote in a very short space of time. This is very easy since it's a very, very simple language. It only has 300 words in it. I think the usual university student uses 400 or 500 words as his standard vocabulary. But Igorote, you see, is almost as bright then as the average university student. But the point I'm making here is that it is not difficult to learn a language if you understand that you are learning a language. But the first way to learn this language is to understand that you are learning a language which maybe has 50, 60, or 70 words. And these words, each one of them has a precise definition. We know what a cat is, a four-legged furry animal of a certain size that habitates London. And it eats fish and mews. It has a certain role as relates to mice. This is then an understanding of this word cat. Well, now the phenomena which we have named is, oddly enough, almost all of it as visible as a cat. We have not named to any extent invisible phenomena. This phenomena is viewable, and this is quite important, you see. An engram is a viewable thing. If you've ever run one on a preclear, you would know how visible it was to the preclear and to you. It's a visible thing. All right, the first word we have, however, in the entire language of Scientology is, unfortunately, a non-viewable thing. And it is non-viewable, but it is experienceable. So it isn't completely removed into the never-never land, and that is static, the word static. And we have, again, crossed languages. We have used an engineering term, static, in its exact, precise meaning. We have used it more precisely than the engineer. But nevertheless, we get into quarrels with engineers about this word static, because he knows what a static is. A static is a thing which is sitting in a balance of forces. The forces which hold it up and hold it down and hold it in place in all directions are all balanced, and they are all motionless, and therefore the static is motionless. And that is the engineer's definition, roughly, of a static. In other words, that chair sitting here is a static because it's in a state of balanced motion. The engineer, however, is speaking with a limited view, so limited that anyone with any broader knowledge of existence than engineering tables immediately quarrels with the definition. He says, what do you mean, static? That chair is traveling in 8 directions. By the rotation of the earth alone, it is traveling at 1,000 miles an hour. What do you mean, static? Well, all right, so we say static. It has no mass, no motion, you see. It has no wavelength, has no energy, and it actually has no finite location, has no size. Now, we define the static by negatives. And so it is not viewable. What do you know? It's experienceable. You say to somebody, be 3 feet back of your head, and he experiences static. So that's exactly what we mean. Now, if we don't know the meaning of the word, then we go afloat immediately. We're just adrift. We'd think a pre-clear was a chair if we followed the engineer's thinkingness along this line. The pre-clear is a chair. He's not a chair. He's a static. A chair is not a static. You actually have to unprove something in engineering to prove what a static is. We probably shouldn't have done it. We probably should have used totally this word theta and thetan, which is simply a mathematical symbol. Somebody thinks that has very mystic connotation. Well, all mathematics have mystic connotation, except mathematicians won't admit it. And therefore, the word theta or thetan means practically the same thing. It's a static. Well, once more, we don't view this thing. We can experience, however. We can know it. We don't have to view it. Now, from there on, however, we do have, oddly enough, almost all of our terminology in viewable form. It is examinable. It practically has mass. It can be weighed. It can be metered. It is the darndest thing you ever saw. A fellow named Wundt started out in 1879 in Leipzig, Germany, and invented a thing called psychology, which was the marrying of mental sciences to physiology and the explanation of behavior through physiological manifestations and conditions. And he explained behavior by physiological conditions, and this was, and probably to a lesser extent, is psychology. All right. He decided to study the mind through scientific means. That is the more current definition that you hear concerning psychology. This, however, was not Wundt's fixation. Wundt's idea was to study it through physiology. Get the slight difference here. It wasn't merely to apply scientific methodologies to the mind. It was to study the mind through physiology. And the mind has been viewed since through physiology. Well, the man's hunch wasn't too far wrong in that practically everything in the mind which is viewable, and does have some mass and does exist in space and is something that you can put your paws on very easily, you know, and you can say, that is that, see? Now, if you don't know this, then you're apt to go adrift on our terminology and on Scientology itself. You're apt to go badly adrift. You're apt to believe that we're dealing with abstracts and intangibles just because the mind has almost always dealt with the mind in abstracts and intangibles. Almost always, see? Somebody's always dealing with abstracts and intangibles to such a degree that this may be an overlooked supposition on your part. You may be believing at this, or just believe before this moment, that we were actually studying abstracts and intangibles. We're not studying abstracts and intangibles in Scientology. Psychology studied abstracts and intangibles, but we're not. We're studying viewable, measurable, weighable, meterable phenomena right below the level of static. Got a static, and then we immediately go into experienceable, viewable phenomena, and even a static is experienceable. So we're not outside the realm of experience any place in Scientology. And nearly everything we have is something that can have a concrete form or example. It's quite interesting, and I'm just giving you this momentary pass brush at terminology itself so that you will see that if this word randomity and if the word automaticity cannot be clearly understood, it must be viewed then as some abstract thing. And it's not an abstract thing. The word randomity means, in essence, it means comparable motions. In essence. Comparable to what? To the consideration of motion. So we have plus randomity and minus randomity. In other words, we can have, from the individual consideration, too much or too little motion or enough motion. What's enough motion? Well, I don't know. You ever see a fellow eating? He thought he was eating just about the right speed, and you thought he was eating too fast, and the fellow across the table from you thought he was eating too slow, see? He thought he was eating just right. You think he's eating too fast. The fellow across the table thinks he's eating too slow. So it is a consideration of motion. A cop is in the field of automobile traffic with the consideration of minus randomity compared to the motorist's idea of motion of cars. See? The cop's consideration, his optimum consideration, is minus randomity compared to the motorist's consideration. See, the motorist thinks his speed or travel or confusion of traffic or vehicle handling and so forth, let us say, is at one level of randomity. It's just about that much randomity. There's motion, cross traffic, and so forth. And he knows what's good. He knows that the traffic is flowing, that the roads are usable. And if you've ever gone down a deserted highway or a lot of deserted highways, you usually think you were doing all right. But if you will remember it, you had a little vague suspicion if there was no traffic on it at all, except you. Something is a little bit funny about going down that road all by yourself, you know. There is no other traffic to view. This tells you at once that it may or may not be a road. See? You know that you consider it a road, but do other people? Maybe it's under repair. Did you ever have the idea of being on a big, broad 8-pass or 6-pass concrete highway, and you were the only car on it, and you didn't see any other car, and you begin to wonder after a while, is this under repair? Am I on a detour? Have I gotten up here on these concrete strips before they're opened? See? Well, it takes a certain amount of traffic for a motorist to know that he's on a highway, let us say. He is reassured by this amount of traffic. A London taxi driver put out someplace let us say he's put in Limerick. He'd be an unhappy man. He's below his traffic tolerance or randomity. He wants that much randomity, and he would miss it. He would feel absolutely alone. Only 4 or 5 cars shooting across in front of him every hour. Only 2 or 3 traffic boo-boos a day. Not enough traffic to make any real confusions. No tie-ups, no jams. You never run into any traffic and have to sit there for 3 or 4 minutes so you get a chance to light a cigarette and take a breather, you know. No traffic jams to be utilized in any characteristic whatsoever. Well, he has developed a certain tolerance for traffic confusions and so on. We don't consider traffic in terms of speed. We consider it in terms of random particles, which have certain channels, but which are nevertheless pretty random on those channels. All right, so he has one idea. His idea is his randomity of traffic. After you've been driving in London for a little while, you start to come up to a tolerance or a randomness, which makes you comfortable, more or less, in its traffic. You start up toward that, you can adjust your idea of randomity. That is speed, that is game. Randomity also contains the aspect of unexpectedness. And this whole thing of unexpectedness is inherent to the idea of randomness. In other words, you have to have enough unexpectedness. And your idea of how much unexpectedness in motion there should be is just your idea of this, that's all. There is no other measure. But you have an idea of how much unexpectedness there should be in life. Well, so does the London taxi driver have the idea of how much unexpectedness there should be in traffic. And if he were to drive in a totally orderly community, where the unexpectedness was zero, this man would probably go to sleep or go unconscious. He would do something. He would eventually run off the road or something. But maybe if after he was at it for many, many weeks, he would, quote, get used to it, unquote. Now, this word randomity then contains the idea of conditioning. and is the only place where we find the subject of conditioning in Dianetics and Scientology. Now, the reason I'm talking about randomity at all is it's one of the wider concepts and a little harder, perhaps, to grasp than any other thing. Yet, you can set it up and view it. You can view it very easily. You can take some chap and set him up at a table and move marbles out of small holes in the top of the table, making them pop up and run on certain courses. At any level, you know, any number of marbles, any unexpectedness, any randomness, of course, and actually find where he feels most comfortable. After a little while, he's liable to get nervous if you throw too many marbles out of those holes. The marbles are coming out of the holes, and there are just lots of them, and they're disappearing in other places, and they're dropping out of sight and appearing, and they're going smash, smash, crack, 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 crack around. And he's liable to sit there and he's saying, "No, this is just too damn many marbles. Don't like this." But just below that level, he says, "Well, that's interesting. You know, marbles popping up and disappearing. And so that's interesting." And just below that level, he sits there and says, "Marbles." See, there's one pops up and runs across the table, drops out of sight. Another one pops up, runs across the table, and drops out of sight. Another one pops up, runs across the table, drops out of sight. Harvey says, "Marbles." Get the idea? That is minus randomity. When he was interested, that was his randomity. That was an optimum randomity, as far as he was concerned. When you had too many marbles moving too fast from too many directions, you had plus randomity. With relationship to what, though? With relationship to this person, this thinkingness, this mind. His idea of randomity was what it was. Or we take some young kid, we have to have those marbles coming out of those side pockets and shooting across to the other side. That's such a blur and a whir with such speed and savageness and unexpectedness and such cracks and pops that you yourself would stand there probably and say, "Nuh." And this kid says, "My, how interesting." You know? If he was really in good condition, it'd be very hard to set up something that had enough unexpectedness in it. With this little kid, you drop him down to the first fellow's number of marbles, which was optimal randomity for this fellow's marbles. And he says, "Yeah, let's go out and play ball." Not interested, you see. Now, we have to have this thing called randomity. It's an unfortunate thing if it is incomprehensible at times. We have to have this thing, plus randomity, minus randomity, and optimum randomity. What is his idea of unexpected motions? What is his idea of unexpected motion necessary to the living of a life? How much unexpected or random motions does he have to live? Which at the same time would say, stay interested in life. How much would he have to have? A boy in space opera? Wow. Wow. Well, you have to have a fight between fleets at least once a week. You didn't have a good liberty at all unless five men were killed. That planet was no fun at all. After they'd shot all the women, there was just nothing left to do. Idea of the amount of motion or unexpectedness or sudden event or twist and turn to life is very, very high, you see, tremendously high. Therefore, you have space opera engrams very easily in suspense on the track. They've looked like confusion. Fellow's been in space opera, and now he looks at these engrams and he says, "Motion, that's confusion." Now, the only reason we're resurrecting this word and dusting it off and using it more frequently is it is a better statement than confusion. It's a better statement of confusion than the word confusion. because the word confusion means at once plus randomity, and is therefore a specialized kind of randomity. It means motion, unexpected, above the tolerance level of the person viewing it. And that is the definition of the word confusion. So if a stable datum is necessary to align data, and if a stable datum can be pulled out of an area of aligned data with a resultant confusion, we have to have a better understanding of what we mean by confusion. If we're going to process it, for heaven's sakes, we'd better understand it. It better be a nice, clear thing to us. Because we're liable to look at the preclear and consider that he is under a confusion, when as a matter of fact, he might be at a minus randomity. Now, things are too slow would be a good statement of a minus randomity. Things are certainly slow around here. Life is dull. There is nothing happening. That's just a statement of minus randomity. It's just consideration of how much motion and unexpectedness of motion there is in the environment. Just how much unexpected happenstance, how much pattern of action there is in the environment. And this would be minus randomity when it was too little for the tolerance of the individual. So we don't have a word to match confusion. There may be one, but from where I'm standing right now, it looks like a hole in the language. Once more, we have to have this word randomity. It's describing something which has been viewed, which is not adequately described in English, and that we are viewing it and describing it and naming it somewhere within the bounds of comprehensibility is quite remarkable, to say the least. So we have minus randomity as the opposite of confusion. Things are too stable. Things are much too stable. Do you know that little Benny has not fallen out of the window for 3 days? Do you realize I have not burned myself all morning? Do you realize there hasn't been a single accident out there on the highway all afternoon? Get the idea? Minus randomity. How dull. Everything is traveling only at rocket speed. You see? Now, that's one guy's idea of minus randomity, or opposite of confusion. Things are not sufficiently confusing. Things are not sufficiently random, unexpected, and not sufficiently in motion. So he's saying, how dull, how dull. This other guy looks at one horse walking down one street and says, ah, horse. Things are going too fast around there for him. Now, unless you understand there can be a difference of consideration about this, you'll have a hard time trying to grip the preclear's idea of how much stable data he needs. Now, how much stable data do you suppose this fellow needs? Horse, one horse going down the street. How much stable data does he need? He needs one stable datum per particle, which in itself is enough to produce a randomness the like of which you never heard of after you've gone very far, you see. One stable datum per particle. Therefore, he needs an enormous amount of information to keep the world from falling in on him and turning upside down and spilling in his lap. He just needs a tremendous quantity. He needs dictionaries full. He needs encyclopedias full. He needs libraries full. He needs scribes in every way, shape, and form, and on every side, working constantly and continually to catalog, 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 catalog. Each word to him is not only a stable datum, it's a sacred datum. If we move just one word out of line in a cataloging of 100 million words, this fellow would go, yeah. Got the idea? Now, we have sciences which are cataloging sciences. If Francis Bacon hadn't wanted to give an example of what science was, we would probably never even today, have a science of botany. But Bacon gave an illustration about it one day, and he wrote it down, and he said, this is the way you could put a science together, and it ought to be this way. And they used this instantly, because he used the classification of flowers as an example. And so on. When we have a science, well, it has that much foundation, the same foundation it had the day he wrote it. And from there on, it is catalog. Get the idea? For a fellow to study botany, he has to be willing to tolerate a tremendous lack of motion from most of our viewpoints. But from his own viewpoint, his ability to tolerate no motion, you see, at all, or motion, never comes into question, really, with him. He's working at it. He's cataloging. He's doing just fine. He's cataloging. He's naming this. He's naming that. He's listing it. He's describing that. He's naming that. And he's perfectly happy. That's one stable datum per item. But you see that his tolerance from what we would consider minus randomity must be very great. Most of us look at this, and right now I can see your faces that this is just unthinkably arduous. See? So we actually have an intolerance of that little randomity. Now, he has then, as I say, the bottom line of this thing. The bottom line of this thing would appear to be, at first glance, one stable datum per particle. That would be the bottom of the randomity scale. But it isn't. It isn't the bottom of the randomity scale. The bottom of the scale would be no particles, no space. And we would be back to a static. And out of this, we at once recognize why a static wants havingness and particles. You got a game. South of minus randomity is no randomity of any kind, and people don't usually like this. Now we start up scale and we get a few particles, and if an individual finds these particles scarce and so on, and his tolerance of them or his necessity not to have anything confused, he can be at this point for two reasons. He can be at this point because he's shuddering away from confusion, therefore he's getting a stable datum per particle, you see. Or he could be at that point because he has a tremendous tolerance for confusion and for motionlessness. Now, if he is cataloging one stable datum per particle at the minus randomity end of the scale, if he's going at this rate, then he is doing this interesting thing, this fabulous thing. This fellow is shuddering away from all confusions and particles, because he's trying to use up all existing particles and stable data. Because he's trying to match these two things. So therefore, he's trying to use up all possible confusion. Now, if he had a high tolerance of confusion in the first place, and he used up all these particles in this fashion, giving a stable datum to each one, getting everything cataloged, everything in order in this fashion, he'd run out of confusions. And he would have a scarcity of confusion. So we take another look at this randomity scale, and we could have a scarcity of confusion or a scarcity of motionlessness. See, we could have a scarcity of either end, not depending on which way we were viewing it. We simply could have either condition. Or we could have both conditions. A scarcity of motionlessness, a scarcity of confusions. Either condition could exist. Now, we ask this, what is confusion and what is motionlessness, which is not a good opposite. What is, then, plus randomity and what is minus randomity? And we have to answer it from the viewpoint of the individual, something which has too much motion in it for his tolerance is plus randomity, and that thing which has too little motion in it has too little motion for his tolerance, you see. Now, how we get him into this state is the entire subject of scarcity. Scarcity. Fellows who don't like motion, who get up into plus randomity with great speed, You know, immediately they get into plus randomity. You know, a second horse gets on the street and they have a nervous breakdown. See? That fellow will have a tendency to do this. Instead of matching a stable datum per particle, he will take all particles and stop them. He starts to apply force and then brings all these particles into a mass so that they're each taken care of. He can then look at this whole group of particles and he can say, that's a table. Okay. That whole group of particles, and he can say, that's a rock. Boy, it's a very satisfactory thing, you know. Look at, we've got all the particles named. Their name is rock. In other words, he takes a mass shock, this thing. He just says, well, we're not going to name each one of these particles. We're not going to do anything. There's not going to be any stable datum for each one of these particles or anything like that. We haven't got time to do that. Look at all that motion. Crush, crunch. Ah, the name of each one of them is a rock, but the name of the composite whole is a rock, and we have mass. It's as easy as that. That is the state of mind which gets you mass. Unless you simply mock it up to have mass, you understand? There's always that one. You can simply mock something up to have mass. You can mock up a universe to have a universe. Or you can evolve them, or you can have reasons for them. But this is usually the case, that an individual who is obsessively making mass has an intolerance of motion to the degree that a second horse on the street would give him a nervous breakdown. So he takes any particles that are in motion, and he says, stop, get, now, a rock. Well, now he can have some peace around here, see. Fellow in space opera, there's been a riot that morning. There's been a fire in Bunker 4. There have been three guys escaped out of the prison and were shot in the courtyard and so forth. And this fellow is saying, gee, things have slowed down. Let's create some confusion around here and get some motion started. Let's drop a false message into the message center that we're about to be attacked by the Peruvians or something, you know. Let's get something going around here. I'm going nuts, you know. Nothing moving at all. Get the idea? Well, now that individual will disperse things. He'll disperse things, preferably with them unknown. And then he has an enormous amount of data, none of which have any identification at all. His level of expectedness and unexpectedness is just way up. So here goes the data. He'll say, gee, I wonder if I can possibly make head or tails out of any of this. Gosh, look at that. Three of my friends in shot, and I'm plugged, and you know, I can't make any sense out of it at all. Wonderful. Now, you get the idea, then, how people vary unexpectednesses and motions to fit their own considerations. Now, there is a state of good health in connection with this. There is a state of good health. That sounds odd, but there is one. And that is for an individual to act in either capacity by changing his consideration on the subject of randomity itself. In other words, retain or attain the liberty of increasing or decreasing tolerance on motion at will. You can look at two horses on the street and say that's too many, or look at a morning in space opera and say that's too slow, with no difficulties whatsoever. See? Or you could say the morning in space opera was too fast, or the two horses on the street were not enough. You could do anything you wanted on it, you see. But where an individual has lost his ability to vary his consideration of confusion and motionlessness, which is to say is plus and minus randomity, where he's lost his ability to shift his considerations, he has lost his ability to have a game, and will then find himself being put out of games which don't fit his fixed opinion. Therefore, he has limited himself in the number of games into which he can enter. And as an individual can shift his consideration of randomity, so he can play large numbers of games. And as his consideration on the subject of randomity becomes more and more fixed, so that there's just a certain amount of motion that he can tolerate, just a certain amount of motion that he can't tolerate, when he's right there somewhere on the scale between total confusion and total motionlessness, and that's it, he has to find a game which fits that idea of a game. His idea of a game, then, is optimum randomity. What is a game? A game is optimum randomity. What is a satisfactory game? A satisfactory game is optimum randomity. What is an ended game? An optimum randomity. We don't care whether it's plus or minus. The game became too fast for him. The game got too slow for him. We just went both ways on the same side of a fixed consideration. An individual's ability to live, then, to a marked degree depends upon, his ability to shift his consideration of what is confusion, what is motionlessness. See? And if he can't shift this opinion, he's sunk. The organization or the person which tells the individual to conform to the environment, tells him to fix his opinion of randomity to that environment, has asked the individual to die the moment the randomity factor alters in the environment. It's asking him to run out of game. Now, I'll give you an idea of this. I think London, just a few years ago, if I remember rightly, there were some chaps that lost their way and dropped their lunch pails or something around here. Isn't that right? They flew over London and created a little confusion, electric motion. Something like that happened anyway. Now, these chaps created a different speed in the environment, didn't they? There was a different speed. An additional amount of confusion was in the environment. Supposing an individual had been totally fixed on the speed of the environment, or the amount of randomity in the environment prior to that incident, supposing he'd be totally fixed, the exact speed of traffic, the exact speed of mail delivery, the exact speed of motion in the city in general, and its various supply lines and so on, supposing he'd been totally fixed at that speed, and all of a sudden, why, some of these chaps come over and mistake some of the open fields and drop their bombs by mistake and so on. He would have done just what he did. He would have blown up right where he was. He would have gone mad suddenly, so mad that he would have gone into a rigidity of some kind. You wouldn't even have been able to detect it as insanity. You wouldn't have been able to have detected it as insanity. It just would not have been insanity. It would have happened too suddenly, as far as he was concerned. So we get this fantastic report that during the bombings of London, there were no reports of any psychosis occurring as a result thereof whatsoever. One of the wilder reports I have ever read. What about those chaps in the airplanes? You mean there was no psychosis around London at that time? Well, if there were no reports on psychosis, it just meant the telephone lines were down. that's about all, see? But another factor enters in to this, which is the saving grace, and that is the emergency factor or necessity level. And a necessity level is a sudden increase, always, obviously, an increase of randomity to a sufficiency that the individual makes a momentary adjustment to it. In other words, he increases his tolerance for unexpected motion. The unexpected motion is there so great that it puts him into higher level of motion, and he takes care of it. See? Now, that is necessity level. It is the randomity itself driving the person. And when the randomity kicks the person, if you'll excuse me, in the butt, he knows he must move. Get the idea? But necessity level only occurs where the individual is in a total stimulus response condition with the randomity itself. And there's nothing to count on at all you create that much more motion, and people are just as likely to stay fixed as to go faster. You create too much randomity, too fast, and people will stay fixed. They will not react on a necessity level at all. Now, unfortunately, there's really no such thing as a non-necessity level or a non-emergency level. In other words, things all of a sudden move too slow for the individual. And we don't have any mechanism to take care of that. See, things are going too slow for the individual. Well, what mechanism would we take care of that with? There isn't any. So people try to build up their tolerance for speed by going faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And they go faster and faster and faster, and they think then they can go faster and faster and faster, and they never drop back toward tolerance of motionlessness. It's actually more important in this time and place to adjust people's ideas of motionlessness and their tolerance for motionlessness than their tolerance for speed. Quite curious, but it is more important to adjust in that direction than the other. There are very many ways you could do this. You could have the guy sit motionless for a long time, but he usually can't tolerate that. You've exceeded his tolerances instead of building his tolerances on a gradient scale, permitting him a permissive spotting of things, which are in motion or not in motion, will gradually bring him to an adjustment of the situation. He must be brought to a point where he can tolerate, by his own consideration, things which are not in motion. One of the ways he does this is to say they're going fast when they're practically standing still, and then he tolerates them easily, but actually he's gotten around it. He actually hasn't tolerated the motionlessness, he's tolerated his new consideration. All right. Now, this is interesting that the auditor has so much to do with this today. He has to do with this because he can produce randomity in the individual with the greatest of ease. He can produce plus or minus randomity in the individual. He can stuff the individual full, one way or the other, of stable data. And that produces for the individual to some degree minus randomity. He can pull some stable data out of the bank, and he will at once produce plus randomity. He can do something to the individual stable data. Give him more or give him less. And alter his reaction to motion. In other words, change his randomity by handling data. That's a fantastic thing. But remember, this is a low order of thing compared to changing the consideration of a person. Now, you have to know that you can add to and subtract from the data of an individual and thereby give him plus or minus randomity. Remember, though, he'd only get plus or minus randomity if he had a fixed consideration of the situation. But you have to know this business about pulling out or putting in stable data, producing plus or minus randomity. You have to know that because it explains the various reactions of the pre-clear to auditing. That's what happens. It explains his various reactions. He's learning more. The world's getting more and more even, more and more stable to him, more and more real. He's learning more. And all of a sudden, he adjusts by giving up a stable datum, which you very often misname a consideration. See? See, he gets more and more data, and his attitude, his consideration of randomity is fixed. So as you give him more data, and he spots more things, and he gets more stable data all around, why, he simply gives up some of his old. You haven't actually changed his randomity. If you're doing a smooth job of ARC, you're gradually upgrading him to a higher tolerance of everything. Okay. Gradually. But he will adjust it. One of the ways he adjusts is to suddenly spit out some old aberrated datum. That was a stable datum. He's got new stable data. He has simply moved in one stable data and moved out one stable data. The point of that, by the way, is you have to change his consideration of speed, that's all. You have to change his ability to change his consideration of speed. Well, then what's this thing called automaticity? If automaticity is related to randomity, which it is, then it would have a lot to do with consideration too, wouldn't it? Well, automaticity means non-self-determined action which ought to be determined by the individual. The individual ought to be determining an action, and he is not determining it. That's a very broad consideration. It is something not under the control of the individual. But if we said something not under the control of the individual as the total, unqualified definition of automaticity, we would have this then. That car which just went down the street would be an automaticity to you. You didn't have control of it. See? So this is not its precision definition. Precision definition is which ought to be under the control of the individual. Activity which ought to be under the control of the individual, which isn't. Now, an individual will tolerate within himself so much random action of the materials which he ought to be controlling. For instance, you, if you're a fairly good driver, will have no difficulty when you're starting your car in the morning in tolerating the fact that it killed a couple of times before you got it going, you know? So the sudden stopping of the motor was really not an automaticity to you, was it? That's really not an automaticity. There's an expectedness in it. But let's take unexpectedness. You shifted the gears and you didn't quite get it in gear. If your tolerance, randomity was good, you see, your ability to change consideration was good, you flipped the gear in. And it didn't quite go in and you had to make a second pass at it. That's an unexpected motion, isn't it? It's not really an automaticity, except in the severest definition of the words. Something has occurred which you should have controlled but didn't. Now, we see this mainly and use it mainly in connection with just this. Motion in the bank, under the control of or not under the control of the individual. And many an individual will get all kinds of fast motions in the bank, fast motion of pictures, machinery, and action, and so forth, and not even consider it vaguely random. Thing is shifting all over the place, they say, that's all right, that's all right, you know. But they ought to be controlling it. It ought to be doing what they say. Well, from their opinion, it is. Another fellow with a different consideration of randomity gets one picture shifting an inch to the right unexpectedly. There's an automaticity going on here, he says. Another fellow has a machine, and he tells it to mock up dogs. So it mocks up blue dogs, pink dogs, and then moves over to the other side, mocks up green dogs, purple dogs, and then mocks up from the back dogs with hats on, dogs with canes, dogs with heavy fur, dogs with light fur, dogs with 5 feet, dogs with 2 feet. See? Zrrr. Life's running as usual. Now, when the preclear says to you, there's an awful lot of action in the bank, that means that he considers that the action in the bank which he is confronting is an awful lot. It doesn't tell you how much action is in the bank from your viewpoint. Got that? So it's the preclear's consideration and opinion that makes an automaticity, not yours. It's the amount of randomness which ought to be controlled, but which he isn't controlling. And this depends on the amount of randomness which he can tolerate. And if he can tolerate a tremendous amount of randomness, plus or minus, then nothing looks automatic to him at all. And the funny part of it is, he can control it too. And where these two things join at the crossroads, you get control of phenomena in the bank. If an individual can tolerate it, he can control it. If he can't tolerate it, he can't control it. And that's all there is to it. I hope you have some better understanding of these two words and what we are doing today, the relation of stable datum to confusion is actually the relation of a stable datum to randomity. But you have to have a clear understanding of randomity before you enter in upon that. I hope this clarified a few things for you. Has it?
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much.